and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It is January 11th, 2017. Welcome to Bicycle Talk. This week with my co-host Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or would like to contribute information to the show, please call or text at 860-486-9487, or you can email me at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. If you're listening to us on podcast, you can also send over an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. Please feel free to comment. We love to hear from you. So that's a really cool thing. Starting out, as always, with Ron's rant of the week. You got to have a rant, right? Got to have a rant. It's always a rant. So here's my rant of the week, because this is like a timely thing, because it's the first of the year, and it's cold out. And it's not cold out today, actually. It's quite nice. But it's cold out, and people tend to kind of forget about their bikes a little bit this time of year, and they're thinking of other things, or they're trying to stay warm, or they're riding their bikes indoors, or whatever they're doing to try to keep themselves busy. There are these things called, what we refer to them in the industry as the LBS, or the local bike shop. And the local bike shops are sitting there, and they are not seeing anybody walk through their door. So my rant this week is against the people who don't go and visit their local bike shop. You should go down, visit your local bike shop, and say hi to them. You don't have to buy anything. You can just walk in and say hi. These are people that love bicycles as much as you love bicycles, and they love to talk about bicycles, and they're, quite honestly, they're cold and they're lonely. And so it's time to get down and visit your local bike shop. Hey, bring them a cup of coffee, a cup of hot chocolate, you know, something to just cheer their day up a little bit. And if you want to bring them some business, that's a good thing, too. It's always nice. This is a great time to get your bike overhauled and fixed and, you know, get it ready for spring, that sort of thing. So go down and have a chat with them and keep them company, because it's a good thing to do. So there's my rant for this week. Cyclocross wrap-up. You know, I've been talking to cyclocross for a while now, obviously. Sometimes you're probably getting sick of it because I've been talking about it so much, and I've had so many guests on that we've talked about cyclocross with. But the wrap-up is the Hartford cyclocross race was unbelievably successful. And this was our national championship race. It's the first time we've had a national championships in Hartford. So that was really cool. Although I may get a fact check on that, because I have a guest here that might be able to correct me on that from the way, way past. But anyway, we'll get back to that. It was a successful race. There was not a course that was exactly the same every single day. Every single day had different courses because of first day, lots of mud. Just lots of mud. It got real warm. The mud just covered the whole surface of the course. There was no snow yet. There was a permafrost underneath. It was sloppy. It was slippery. It was impossible in some places. It was perfect cross weather. Second day, things got a little sloppy again, a little rainy, but then it started drying up, and everything dried up pretty quick, and it tacked out, and the course was much faster. The lap times were a lot faster. That was kind of cool. Next day comes along, and we got the deep freeze, and everything got real hard, and the ruts became frozen. And when you're riding your bicycle through a frozen rut, if you've ever done this with a front wheel, it tends to grab onto your front wheel and grabs it and throws you down onto the ground if you're not careful. So then we moved on to the weekend, and as we moved into the weekend, we got a great little surprise and gift to cross, and that was we got a snowstorm, and the snow just dumped about probably 4 or 5 inches on Hartford, and more in eastern parts of the state and less in western parts of the state, but it just changed everything. And then after that, just to add to all that and fill it in, there was we had this unbelievable cold snap come in. And so not only did we have snow on the course on the last day, but we had changing conditions due to depending on what time of day you were at. So during the middle of the day, the snow was soft and it was pretty easy to ride in, sort of, except for all the ruts that you were still dealing with. And then at the end of the day, it turned into ice. So everything changed, and some of the top riders in the elite races were actually changing bikes halfway through the race because of the condition and the temperature of the snow. And they were changing over to more of a file tread tire to be able to, which was something you wouldn't use normally in the snow. You would use it on like a grassy surface, a smoother grassy surface. But they were using it on that because it was getting better traction for them, and it was a little faster because the surface was so hard. So everything was crazy. Bikes were breaking. Things were going nuts. It was just, what a great race. It was just really fun. So that's going to be my brief cyclocross wrap-up. I've got another guest in a couple of weeks, and we're going to get into this in detail. So to move on from that and move on to our guest, I have a guest in the studio today. My special guest is Bill Humphreys. And good morning, Bill.
Hey, Ron. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks. So Bill Humphreys has also a nickname, and that is...
The bike guy.
Yeah, there we go. So you know, we're all bike guys out there, but Bill, you're especially a bike guy. You have been at this for a long time. I remember you come from days of racing 10 years before I come from days of racing.
Okay.
So why don't you give us a little history?
Oh my God. Well, the bike guy is my moniker, and that got assigned to me. I got tagged the bike guy in 1973, while at a stage race in Canada with Dave Chawner, two-time Olympian, was the guy that took me under his wing down in Princeton, New Jersey, where I was a member of the Century Road Club of America. And I started training down there, completely an unknown guy. And nobody had ever heard of me. I was a long-haired hippie who, the previous year, the summer of 72, had ridden my bike across America with my hair up under my hat and my pannier bags. And little did I know that the very next year I would be riding the world's championships for the United States. I mean, that's, you know.
What a world we live in. That's great. So I don't know that I was aware of the fact that you had ridden your bike across the country. I did that too. I did that in 75 is when I did it.
Yeah, yeah. And I did it along with, well, I had a partner. I had tried racing in California, San Diego, where nobody gave me much advice. I mean, I was a big, heavy, hairy hippie on a wrong size bike, and let's take him out and drop him somewhere quick. So I didn't get much information there. I had a limited success as a novice. Tried it the second year and said, the heck with this. I can't figure this sport out. I just, you know, I couldn't get the right information. So I said, let me ride my bike, take my energy and ride my bike across the United States. And that's where I began envisioning out there for miles and miles and miles. If I live through this, if I don't get killed out here, I'm going to be a good bike racer when I get to the East Coast. That was my mantra. And it's amazing how much, if you do that every day for 45 days, the following year, you're already programmed.
Well, you have so much muscle memory, and you have such a base that you build from it. You know, when I got back from my cross-country trip, I had 4,000 miles on my legs, and somebody said, you should race your bike. And same. That's how I got into it.
Yeah, you know? Same thing. So, it was a quick rise. I caught the wave. The 70s were a prolific time in American cycling history. this was, I managed to get on the first U.S. team, fully sponsored U.S. team to ever race in Europe. And so for those out there that think the 7-Eleven team might be the big team to do that, we were the precursor. We were 73, and they didn't really race in Europe as a team until the 80s. But we set the tone. We launched, we pioneered the era, along with a bunch of individuals who had gone over to Europe on their own. Mm-hmm. And I had a great career and went right into coaching after that, and was fortunate enough to get under the guise of Eddie B., a Polish guy who had defected from the Polish team after the 74 Worlds.
You were with Eddie B.
I moved in with him just about. Yeah, I knew what he knew. I knew he had all the knowledge. And so I got named right away. The first coach he assigned was, I was the junior national team coach, and that was the famous year that we had, you know, LeMond, Demjan, Kiefel, Carmichael, Rogers, name it.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of rock stars, but they were disciplined, they were hungry, and they knew how important it was that they were getting the tutelage under this guy. They knew as young juniors that the guru of all time had come, and there was no more fooling around. If you didn't want to listen to the bike guy, you had to listen to Eddie B. And the other thing was that the Junior World Championships that year were not in Europe. They were in the United States, so every kid knew, if I make this team, I'm not racing far away where nobody knows what happens. I'm racing right in front of them.
Sure.
And so as a result, they got results. And then they went on to have careers. Every one of these kids went on to race as long as 14 more years.
Yeah, they really, all those guys, they were at it for a long time. And obviously LeMond, I think, probably became the most famous of them all.
Yeah.
Because of his success and his Tour de France fame that really brought him to the spotlight and kind of really started bringing U.S. cycling to the spotlight at that point.
I mean, when he won the Tour and was named Sportsman of the Year for Sports Illustrated, all these pundits on ESPN, everybody was like, who is this guy? How did this happen? And then when they read the story, then they went, maybe this guy deserves it.
Which
was quite an acknowledgement from mainstream media.
Well, you know, you and I come from this world of bicycles where, you know, we know all these people and we're very familiar with it. And it's something that is in our blood, obviously, and we have a passion for it. But there's so much of the United States that just doesn't even know that you could race a bicycle.
And it's still that way. I mean, as much as, you know, and, you know, I'll bring up the Armstrong era because there's, you know, regardless of his situation and what he did, he also made the sport, really penetrated the mainstream media.
He sure did.
You know, so that can't be denied. And now it took a little dip, and now it's settled. And, you know, the pro teams are still racing, and we're still riding in the Tour de France, and we still have amateur teams going to Europe and so forth and so on. But it's still not even close to catching the media's eye in this country.
Right. It'll take a lot more time.
I don't know if it ever will, and that's fine. You know, those of us who love it, you know, we make our inroads. We have our moments. The sport hits a little peak, and that's fine. You know, as long as sponsors still see the value in it and it provides an outlet for kids to travel the world and become totally educated through the sport, then it's okay.
Well, I'm encouraged right now because one of the little side points of cycling, which cyclocross, which is something that I'm very near and dear with and had some success with when I was younger and then went on to develop the sport in New England. It has a lot of attention right now. And not only does it have a lot of attention, but it's still growing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there's talk about, well, it's peaking out. I don't think it's peaking out. I don't think we've seen it yet. We have a way to go until we see that. And so that's good. And what I'm really encouraged by is here in Connecticut, we have a development program, which is over the top.
Yeah.
I think one of the best. Actually, I went to a VIP gathering for the Nationals race at the Wadsworth Athenaeum last week. And Derek Burchard Hall was there, the head of USA Cycling.
Right.
And he called the Connecticut Cycling Advancement Program, CCAP, he called it one of the most progressive organizations in the United States for building junior racing and awareness to bicycle racing.
Yeah, high school area.
Yeah.
Development of kids.
I mean, there's over 500 kids now involved in this in the state of Connecticut, which is like a cool thing.
So,
our time may come again. We'll just be the old guys on the edge of the road ringing the cowbells.
Ron, we've been the old guys for a number of years.
I think you're probably right about that.
Yeah, let me pay kudos to those, to the CCAP. They were actually the organizing committee for this event, and they had very little experience in how to throw an event of this magnitude. They took a big risk. Nonprofit groups that's generally not on their mission statement. Their plate was pretty full with their high school program. It was already successful, and this could have really interrupted that, and this could have been a disaster for them, and they came through, but it was nervous times.
It's big nervous times. Yeah. I mean, I caught Aiden a few times when he was at his most nervous point,
and
he was definitely... He was a busy guy.
Yeah.
He was a real busy guy. But they did a wonderful job.
They got through it, and it's a shame it's only a one-time. When you bid on it, you only get it for 1 year.
Right.
What you learn in that year, if you had the second year, you're guaranteed, and then you make some money. They don't get that opportunity, but they have this feather in their cap, and they had some economic impact with the city of Hartford. And overall, it's going to help their program immensely. So, you know, kudos to them. And that you're right, that, you know, that segment of the sport in New England and around the country is a very fast growing segment, very fast growing. Yeah.
And I think with the impact that they had and the positive results that they had from it, if they were to put another bid in, they would certainly be considered.
Well, and 3 more years, they're going to go back to multi-year bids. So, you know, that option exists in 3 years from now. They may have their own successful program by then.
Sure.
That doesn't need or require them to be, quote unquote, national championship, because with that, as you know, comes a lot of politics and a lot of rules and regulations that are stifling. An individual promoter with a great sponsor and the city behind them can almost match that without that all the politics.
So, there's already talk, I can tell you right now.
Oh, yeah, the momentum, yeah.
Yeah. So the city of Hartford, you know, I met with the mayor twice during this past week. The folks at Riverfront Park,
they're the key.
Riverfront Recapture, they are so elated by what they saw. They had no idea how big this thing could be.
No.
And I think they got a really good taste. Yeah. I haven't had any follow-up meetings with them, but I'm gonna give them a call in a couple of days.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be
just
several.
get an earful from them, because they you know, from what I saw, from just, you know, walking around the course, monitoring the course, I was doing a lot of marshalling during the race, as well as, you know, set up and breakdown. And you know, their mouths were open. You know, they were really, really impressed by it. But, you know, it takes, you know, people like yourself who've been involved in this for many years to get involved with the kids and get to that coaching level and encourage them. And nothing can replace enthusiasm.
No, and you know, it's a feather in their cap. It got the attention. Now we got to look forward to what else can New England do with the overall New England racing scene and the Connecticut racing scene. I mean, it is non-existent. Okay,
right.
So the drop off to the spring road racing season into the summer, it's all small races. No national prominence. There's just a handful of decent size, marketable races in New England at this point.
Well, the big races are gone.
Yeah,
you know,
so
the main international gone.
Oh yeah.
The the Putney Road Race, Tour of the Valleys.
Oh my God, you're way back.
Remember that? Yeah. Oh, I raced that. That was a great race. That was my favorite.
Well, the big weekend was Hartford, Fitchburg, Walpole.
Right, I mean, and then there was that. Right,
you know, and that was an institution that drew the best riders and included travelers.
Right, it
you
did.
Know,
it was called the Traveler's Criterium.
In 1970, it was 1973.
Mm-hmm.
I raced in front of 10,000 people in 1973 in downtown Hartford at Bushnell Park. The best riders were flown in. I looked on the starting line. All the sprinters from California, all the best riders were flown in.
Yep.
And other guys came on their own from Michigan and the Midwest and down south. It was like an all-star preview, and they raced Hartford. Then we went up to race Fitchburg, and then or Walpole, depending on the day. So they had three races in a row. That weekend was the king. There was nothing bigger in the United States, and it's not. There's nothing close to that now. So
no.
So you know, Aiden's program is where it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have the big races, but if you don't have the grassroots and you don't have the, you know, to complete that, then you know it doesn't have the momentum. So. With what he's doing and getting high schools involved and getting juniors involved, and then slowly the races will emerge. So, you know, everything's pointed in the right direction for Connecticut.
I think you're right. And, you know, I'm just very, very encouraged by this past week of racing in Hartford and the amount of attention it got. And we're in the middle of the winter, and we're talking bicycle racing. So you know, think about summer. And boy, wouldn't it be nice to bring the big three back? That would be so cool.
Well, you know, Fitchburg still exists, and
it does.
You know, I was when Joe Tosi passed away, and then the Hartford Crit went away. I was living in Boulder, Colorado. And saying to myself, I'm 36, I still have my pro license, I'm going to go back east one more time to ride the big three. It's just a luxury I can afford to go. I'm still fit enough. I'm going to go back there and do it. And I looked on the calendar, and I saw Fitchburg and Walpole, and I didn't see Hartford.
No.
And I said, there's this Worcester. And I said, whoa, somebody jumped on that date, and I called the guy, and I said, you've got a date between two of the biggest, most established races. How did this happen? He said, well, you know, the Travelers went away, and I run this nonprofit group in Worcester. And so lo and behold, I got to be friends with this gentleman, Jerry Dunn, who was the co-author with me on
the
book.
Sure.
But here was a guy that had no background in cycling, but was a promoter and ran a nonprofit for United Healthcare there, a suicide hotline in Worcester. And he got the sponsors. He went up to Dave Pelletier's race in Salem and saw how big that was.
Yep.
And I'm in Worcester on the 4th of July. Worcester's a town you drive through. You don't stop there.
Right, exactly.
You know? What the heck's Worcester? Well, it's the second biggest city in New England. Nobody knows that, right?
Nobody knows that.
There's about 85 ethnic groups living there.
Oh, yeah.
And Spanish and French aren't even on the calendar for the kids there.
11 colleges and universities.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's just...
So I'm in downtown Worcester on 4th of July, and there's 10,000 people watching a bike race named after a guy named Major Taylor.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
In 1980.
Yes.
Okay. And nobody knew who Major Taylor was.
Nobody knew.
So they spread the word on that. Eric and Beth Hyden there. This was a total blowout success and filled that niche for a couple of years. And then we moved on. But that was the last big gasp for that weekend. Fitchburg continued on. But nevertheless, there's...
Then we went down to the small locals, like the New Britain Criterium still kicks around. That's still there. Andy Raymond was putting on a Criterium in Middletown.
Very
that
popular.
Was a pretty big that yep. was a pretty big race.
It
that
was.
That was a good race.
Yeah.
But you know, it's all not there anymore.
Well, you gotta hand it to New Haven for coming back with that race around the park.
Right.
And a Friday night, and that's the format that works. You go to where the people are. One thing about that, Portsmouth, New Hampshire does the same thing.
Yes, they do.
They have a criterium in the downtown where all the restaurants and bars are, so you have automatic audience who are intrigued and stumble on it and love it.
Right.
So once you get it the first year, they go, have that back. Beverly, Massachusetts has one right downtown in the middle of the week, you know, that seems to be...
Yeah,
have that same stigma. So there, you know, the idea is there, but New Haven killed it. New Haven killed it.
Well, you know, there's a faction down there in New Haven. There's a very strong cycling community in New Haven itself. A lot of that comes from Guy and Sue Daniello, who obviously the Amity Bicycle Shop and the Laurel Bike Club, which has been there for a very, very long time.
And Guy the Devil's and Sue Gear are, and
the
what
Devil's
he's done
Gear.
There.
Yeah.
Matthew
Finer is going to be on the show in a few weeks.
He could be the mayor of New Haven.
Yeah, he could. I asked him if he could please come on the show and give me a little update on cycling in New Haven. He said he'd love to be on the show.
So we're gonna
put him on the show in a few weeks, and we'll talk to Matthew about the cycling scene in New Haven because he is as passionate about it as all of us.
Yeah.
And it's
well, Hartford Travelers took their money out of their downtown Hartford race recently and moved it right down there.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
they did.
And we're thinking about moving the cyclocross down there as much as 5 weeks ago.
I know. That was the second go-to on it. That was the plan B of the what happens if Hartford goes underwater because there was that problem.
Yeah.
Because it is right next to the river. And I remember talking to people and I'm saying, why would you move to New Haven? It's like so far away. If everybody's already got their rooms in Hartford, it's gonna be difficult.
But
that was what they were looking at
yeah.
because New Haven's got a pulse right now.
It certainly does.
And you know, and Hartford could have a pulse, and I think that there was a showing there. I know
you're dismissing that collegiate element, you know. I mean that Yale campus and all those bars and restaurants
are right
around the green.
I know.
You know, and the Bushnell Park isn't the same. You know, and you don't have college students in the heart of Hartford.
You're right.
You can't duplicate that.
No, you can't. So you can't. You
know, even maybe Burlington, Vermont. One of the things about the guys that ride that Green Mountain stage race every year that has, you know, God bless those guys. Because, there's no money in it, but they find it. They get it done. But what every racer lives for is that race in downtown around Burlington, around all the bars and restaurants.
Absolutely.
So they'll race 3 days in the mountains and have a miserable time.
Oh, and it's horrid.
Just so the last day, they can feel like a rock star in downtown Burlington.
Sure, sure.
You know, Burlington could just do that on its own.
Well, and downtown Burlington has an air to it anyway,
which
it's a place you kind of want to be.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why this hasn't happened in Boston.
Well, it has, but it's too big.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that TD Bank, threw us all this money. They block off all the big streets. Your Nathaniel Hall, you're there, but people are stumbling on it. They're not there. And they all come in on a Saturday. They fly in, like, right from Vegas in the bike show. They come in on a Saturday. They're there for one day. They ride that thing, and then they're gone.
Right. Right.
You know, when Betty Pelletier did it, it was a tighter circuit.
He drew
true spectators, so they didn't grasp it, and it still goes on, but it's
it's really not on the map.
Yeah, I'm not driving.
I'm thinking about it now and going, oh yeah, that one, but it's an oh yeah that one. It's not really what we are.
Boston itself has grown as a great cycling community.
Boston's a wonderful cycling community.
What Richard's done up there and several other people, I mean, they've had a bike coordinator, a paid position for years.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The mayor's into it.
Mm-hmm.
So Boston has definitely grown as a cycling-friendly city.
Well, Boston is a very cycle commuter city.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what takes over that. And then you have the sub areas, like the Beverly thing that goes on. There's the Salem Witches Cup,
which is still
going on.
Yep.
And that is still a viable race, attracts a pretty good crowd.
Yeah.
And it's through Salem, Mass. So there's a lot of activity. And again, bars and restaurants, that's the key point here.
Yeah, that's strange to be. I was up there and I spent some time with Dave Pelletier recently, and I was driving my tractor trailer.
Yeah.
And I was talking to him on the phone. We were trying to meet up. I said, Dave, I'm on the course. It's 40 years later. I'm on the course with a tractor trailer. What is going through my mind?
Yeah, right.
I better pull over because I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing. You know,
wow.
It was wild.
Wow.
Trip down memory lane. Yeah.
So let's reset here just for a second. I want to go back to your coaching experience.
Yes.
I want to go back to what you were doing with that and how long it lasted and why, and are you still involved with it or are you not involved with it?
Yeah, I had a great career and moved right into coaching and had that fascinating, wonderful experience with the juniors. I was coaching at the Red Zinger Classic and the Coors Classic. I had the AMF team. I had the best riders, and I was, pioneering the soigneur position the whole time. And then that summer, I did a training camp at Copper Mountain before Davis and Connie did it. In fact, they attended part of the camp, and so I was on the leading edge of the coaching, riding the wave. And Eddie B came up to me. I was kind of at the national championships. That summer, and I didn't have any job. I was just there to watch. I wasn't connected to anything. And he came up to me and said, "Bill, how would you like to go? Do you have the time off your job to go to Europe and be the soigneur for the Tour de l'Avenir?"
Ooh!
And I just said, "We're riding." He said, "It's the first time we got an invitation, and I can pay your ticket over if you can go." And I just said,
what an opportunity.
I'm not missing that. You know,
no.
I mean, here I was.
These are things we read about.
Yeah.
Right.
So when I went over, Ed Burke was pioneering that position, but he was a doctor. He was a research guy, and he didn't want to be doing legs and carrying luggage and doing hand-ups, but he was pioneering it. And he kind of opened the door for me, and when I got there, he was still there, and he watched me for a couple of days. He said, "I'm going home. You got it." And so I was the soigneur for that, and then I got to meet European guys that were my idols. Rini Wachmans is a guy I wanted to meet, and then it just blossomed. And I went back in '79. I was over there for 6 or 7 weeks, and I, and some of the things that I, some of the soigneurs I met the night before the World Championships in Holland, how they made up their food and cut their sandwiches and peeled their pears and rolled them in foil, how they did the massage, how they prepared the water bottles, and invited to do the hand-ups at the World. So when I came home in 79 and realized we weren't going to go to Moscow in 1980, and here I was perfectly positioned to be the soigneur.
Right.
I had nobody at that particular time had ever had access to a professional soigneur.
So explain the soigneur.
It's the coach. It's the training guy. It's the athletic trainer of the cycling team. But it means to care for, and you do so much more than massage. You prepare the water bottles for their day, the water bottles after the race. You make sure they you get their luggage to their hotel room. You do 7 massages a day. You make sure they have the warm-ups. You got, you know, you're just the uncle that's there. And they'll end, and when they're on the table, they're going to tell you things about their body that they won't tell the coach.
Right.
And you have to determine, you know, okay, how much more does when Mike Neal would ask me what's going on with so-and-so, you know, he knew I was going to know if they were ready and how they felt the next day. So 16-hour days, I wrote several stories on it. And when I came home, Bill Woodall looked at me and says, "Where are you going?" I says, "We're not going to Moscow. I can't wait 4 more years to be the soigneur. I want to move into promotion, you know.
Okay.
I want to go from being totally broke with no future as a coach to totally broke with no future promoting the sport, just to make sure that I'm totally indebted and to look at my future and say, I want to be sure that I'm a 72-year-old truck driver, and the best way to do that is stay involved with the sport and make no money." And here I am today to tell you that. So.
That's great. which brings us to current times. So you're a truck driver. You're driving a rig.
Yeah.
You're actually working with a friend of mine who is also a cyclist who raced bicycles back in the day. He's a bit younger than us. So
aren't they all? Yeah.
And he certainly has some legs on him that I don't have anymore, but I love riding with him. He's one of my favorite guys to ride with.
Yeah. I came across him. He was buying a bike from a guy that's over my way in East Hampton who has a CDL and had a big old Kenworth and traveled the triathlon circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of an offbeat guy, but he had his niche, and he ended up moving to East Hampton, Connecticut.
Peter?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Peter.
Really, really pretty okay.
Yeah.
And so I had Peter. I got to know him when he moved there, and then I got him a job part-time as a truck driver in the summer, and he didn't last long at it, but he appreciated the fact that I gave it that job. So now I'm driving over the road 48 states, and I run into him, and he's, like, heartbroken because he knows I can't ride my bike that much.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden I get a text 2 years later saying, "Hey, Pride's Corner Farm just bought 2 new tractor trailers, and trailers, and they need drivers, and here's the guy to call. He just bought a bike from me on Craigslist."
Right.
So that's how I got the lead, and I was looking to stay home and get off the road.
Right.
So it all worked out, and I finally met Christian on the job, and we chit-chatted. He says, "Oh, I've got your book." He says to me, "Does the boss know who you are?" I said, "The owner has no idea." Well, you know, he says he likes to ride a bike. He rides a mountain bike, and
he's very enthusiastic about bicycles.
You know,
So
he says, "Does he know who you are?" He says, "No." He says, "I'll tell him." I says, you don't have to do me any favors." So it's been funny, but So I'm driving. I was driving over the road for 2 years. Leave out on Monday, come back on Friday, come back on Saturday, leave out on Monday, sleeping in your truck, one of the 10 most dangerous jobs in the world, and not having time to ride, but having time to reflect on my life.
Sure.
And talking into a tape recorder and realizing you have had one hell of a life.
You sure
have. You need to get this into a book form. And so that's what it's done for me. It's awakened the memory banks.
And that is what you're calling your magic carpet ride?
Yes.
Yes. That's great. So, Bill, have you been driving a truck the whole time?
No, I was 23. I was driving over the road. And believe me, like I said in that piece, if you had told me at age 23, 220 pounds, you know, a 12-pack and 2 pizzas at one sitting... If you had said to me then, "Bill, when you're 28, you're going to be on the U.S. team riding in Europe," I would have said, "What's the U.S. team? What's a stage race? What are you talking about?"
You know, right.
So that's how crazy it's been. And then to realize that I'm back doing it again. The bookends of my life. It's like, you know, filling that in is the key.
Is this a different book than the Jersey Project book?
This is something
You have something else you're working on right now?
Absolutely.
And it's not complete yet?
No. It needs some work. I've got some more writing to do, but all the outlines, a lot of the stuff is there.
Do you have a name for your book yet?
And Audacious has to fit in there somewhere, and you can't make this up. Those combination of words are going to be somewhere involved. Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. That's great. So I look forward to it. I really do.
I appreciate it. A lot of people are anxious to see it, and I've developed a blog now, and I'm going to start contributing to that. And the other thing I'm trying to do is develop my public speaking, get that tuned up.
We can work on this. We can. Yeah. I'm sure that what we're going to cover on this show is going to be just a tip of the iceberg compared to where we could go with this. Okay. As a matter of fact, I completely spaced out and forgot the most important question of the show to start the show out, and that is, you need to tell me, and every guest does this, goes through this, you need to tell me what your very first experience that you can remember with a bicycle was.
I have pictures of me as a kid with the big Columbia, under the tree, classic, 1950s.
That's what you got for Christmas.
And taking the fenders off it slowly, and just had the front fender.
Yep.
And just riding the hell out of it. So, that was in the neighborhood. I mean, that's what you did.
That's what you did.
You went everywhere on your bike.
It's how we got around.
Practice, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Very nice.
So, I mean, I even rode my 3-speed English upright with the I even rode that to high school a few times.
Oh, yeah. I was the weird kid who rode his bike to school. My dad would, my dad owned a service station in Norwich. And when I was 12 years old, I used to get the calls from the house. And my dad would say, pedal your over here. And I would have to go and help him because he'd be busy and he'd be trying to get his repairs done. And so I was there pumping gas and, washing windshields and checking oil. Remember that? When you used to get an actual full service station? And but my mode of transportation was my bike. And my dad would rescue bicycles off of right down the street from him. He was right on Route 2, if you know that area, the Preston-Norwich line.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of junkyards down the street. And scrap metal and cars and that sort of thing. And my dad, when these big trucks had come in, they're buddies of his, they'd stop by and he'd look and he'd see a bike on there, or they'd set a bike aside if they saw one and they'd give it to him, and then he would bring it home and I'd fix it, So I got my first English racer 3-speed off of a junk truck going down to the dump. That's when, that was after, the 20-inch wheel bikes and all the other stuff you grew up with.
Sure.
But when I got 3-speeds, all of a sudden I had range.
Yeah.
Amazing. And it's funny, you don't think about a 3-speed as having range now.
I can't recall.
I mean, my bike has 11 gears in the back now, it's just in the back.
Yeah.
And so, you look at a 3-speed, you kind of laugh about it, but that's what it was.
Yeah.
That's what we did. It was just a different world.
The more recent question that I get is, how did you get involved in bicycle racing? And the short answer is, living in San Diego with no particular direction, but I still had my red Austin Healey.
Oh, you had an Austin Healey.
Oh, yeah. And I was getting too many moving violations, too many speeding, too many wrong turn, left turns, too many of these.
I'll bet you did.
They said, I had to go to court, and the judge looked at me and he says, kid, we're going to take that license from you for 2 weeks, and you got to take this class. And if you come back here ever again, you're never going to see this license again.
Really?
And I said, okay, judge. And I sold the car the next day and bought a bicycle.
How about that? Really?
I had no idea when I bought that bicycle, which was $10. Okay, because the boys in the beach used to take their pickup truck up to San Diego State and just steal bikes, bring them back to the beach, and sell them for $10.
Right.
That was my first bike, was a stolen French 10-speed, which I thought was the fastest thing in the world.
Oh, sure.
And I started riding up and down South Mission Beach and up into La Jolla. And then I bought a $110 bike.
Wow.
And everybody was convinced I had lost my mind.
Well, that's a lot of money back then.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got started. I had no idea where it would end. Yeah, that was it.
Wow. So did you grow up in California?
No, I grew up in East Hartford. Okay. And an old line where I live now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Finally, so, back home. It took me a while to get back to old Lyme.
Yeah.
About 55 years. But
yeah.
I was starting to drag my foot on the highway, wondering when I was going to slow down.
You know, right.
Opening the door, saying, I got this highway goes on forever. I'm dragging my foot. I got to stop.
Oh, my God. That's great. That's great. And so, you know, it's a weird thing. You fall in love with the bike, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, who knew, you know, and riding across the country and then riding into Quebec.
Oh.
You're speaking a different language.
Different world.
You've ridden right off your map. Your map was this long. It was the whole United States. And you wrote off your map and they're speaking a foreign language. All
right.
Because you just kept on pedaling.
Right. And boy, do they know and love bicycles up there.
Yeah,
it's like you're really riding your bicycle into a European city,
exactly.
And everything that they do and how they feel up there about it, it's all just like you're over in Europe. It's very, very interesting.
It was mind-boggling, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the side story is I get to Montreal, and my bike is a mess, and I'm a mess, and I have a place to stay. And I go to the local bike shop, and it's the Italian guys that have been there, you know, been there forever. And I walk in and they look at me like, not a pretty scene. I'm looking pretty bad. And they look at my bike. And I said, I just need a new chain and new cassette. I can't afford anything else.
Right.
And they said, well, did you know about the race? And I said, what race? Yeah, there's the big race this weekend.
Oh,
it starts
geez.
In Quebec City and it finishes in Montreal.
Really?
And I'm going, you're kidding me.
That's a big race.
I hadn't been near a bike rider or a bike shop. I'd been riding solo for so long. I was out of touch with the world, but I said, a bike race, a long one, you know, flat one.
Very long
one,
yeah.
And I've already, you know, I'm going, I got to ride this. And in the shop at the time was a big Italian guy named Mecco who had won stages in the Giro, and he lived in Montreal, and he'd won this race, and he's in the same shop, and I'm looking at him like, this is a god, and I'm going to ride mm-hmm. the same race as this guy?
Yeah.
I mean, I was looking pretty trashy. So I decide I'm going to ride up to Quebec. I'm going to ride the race course in reverse.
Okay.
It's a 172-mile bike race, so I have to sleep in the middle of the race. I get to Three Rivers and spend the night on a picnic bench and finish the ride the next day and say, you know, you're racing that in one day.
Oh, my God.
So when I get to Quebec, of course, it's totally European. It's medieval with a wall. And
oh, yeah.
And I go out and just party my brains out. I give myself 36 hours to recover, and I go to the starting line by the Hotel Frontenac, and there are all the guys, bike racers I haven't seen for 40 days. I've been out of the loop, and I show up with my hair down to my back. I even have a Bacardi sticker on the top tube of my Raleigh Pro that I peeled off a bottle and stuck. I mean, I am the most atrocious looking. A Cat 4 looks good, okay? A Cat 5 looks good next to where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
And I ride up with my Pletcher rack and my pannier bags, and I'm going, I got to get somebody to carry my bags to the finish. Who do I approach? I don't know anybody.
Right.
And I go up to the most prima donna, perfect guy of all time that just doesn't want anything to do with me, Jimmy Hutter out of Buffalo. And he's just been cut from the Olympic team, but he has the Olympic bike. This is 72, so they've all flown to Munich. Jimmy mm-hmm. just didn't quite make it. Mm-hmm. He's there with his bike. And I go up to him and I'm there, hey, my name is Bill. I just rode in from San Diego. Could I borrow a wrench? Could you carry my Pletcher rack to the finish line?
Oh,
Jimmy
God.
Goes, get out of here. He said to his loopy, his mechanic, hey, Dean, you want to talk to this guy?
The Pletcher rack is a total giveaway
oh.
right there. It's like, oh boy, stay away from this guy. He's got a rack on
his
Oh
my
bike.
God. So they took my stuff and I went to the starting line. And all these guys were there from New Jersey. Doug Dale was there. Stan Swain was there. Toby Sweeney. You know, all the New York crowd. Marty, all the mechanics, all the group. Gelano, all those guys were there. I didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
And they were looking and the word got out that there's some guy here that just rode in from San Diego for the bike race. Okay, so I'm in the back of the bunch, and we roll out of town, and I'll tell you what, it was mind-boggling.
Mm.
And at some point, I got dropped, and at some point, I chased back on. Now, that had never happened to me before. When I get dropped in San Diego, that was it.
Yeah.
But I all of a sudden, I started chasing. I got back through the cars, and I caught up to the bunch again. That had never happened. You know,
right.
And I put my arms up and went, yeah, I'm back. And they all looked at me like, we obviously have to go faster to get
right,
rid of
right.
this
we
guy.
Didn't get rid of him the first time. We got to go get him now, right?
Oh. So anyway, that was my introduction. And we got to the finish. I finished about an hour and a half later than everybody else. And there was Jimmy. He had been second. And he had all these guys had prizes in their vans. Mm-hmm. All these vans were getting ready to go back to Jersey and Connecticut and everything. And I'm thinking, you know, I've been on the road a long time, like 45 days. You know, I'm just trying to get to Connecticut. Maybe I should catch a ride with these guys just to get to Vermont, you know.
Sure.
And then finish up my trip. So I went around to each van. I mean, I'm still horrendous. Nobody wants anything to do with me. They're all packed up. And I went to each van and said, geez, where are you guys going? Do you have room in the van for me? And that's all I had was what I was carrying.
Yeah, right. And you and your bike.
Every
right.
one of them too said, no, we got TVs and bikes in here. We got extra prizes. We don't have any room for you. And I looked around and I says, okay. Welcome to the East Coast.
Yeah, not even Doug Dale, huh?
No, and he's my best buddy now.
Yeah, I love Doug. He's a great guy.
But anyway, so that moment there was like, okay, little did I know that I would be on the U.S. team the next year.
Yeah.
You know, little did I know that I would be back riding Quebec, Montreal with John Alice, who was going to win it, John Howard, who was Olympian, Stan Swaim, the list of guys, and I showed up with the Raleigh jersey. And Jimmy Hutter looked across the room at me. He was on the same team, and he kept looking at me. He says, I know this guy. And I'm hoping he doesn't recognize me, right? So Jimmy's looking at me. He goes, wait a minute. You're the guy that came up and asked me for a wrench to remove your Pletcher rack. And that the whole room just broke up. They couldn't believe that I had come that far, that I was the hippie from the year before.
Oh, that's too funny. That's great. I rode my bike across the country with a Pletcher rack. That's what I had.
Yeah.
That's what there was.
Standard attire, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. That's amazing. Wow. That's a big jump.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was, and that's what my speaking is about, is the inspiration, the focus, you know, the focus it took to go from there to being back with those guys in 1 year, being in the right place with the right time, surrounding yourself with guys that are better than you.
Mm-hmm.
Just surround yourself with them,
right?
And they didn't coach you so much as you learned from them.
Sure. Well, you kind of watched. You know, it's like when I got into bike racing, I got taken in by Cat 2 friends, who said, you know, you need to be racing a bike. They take me out for a couple of rides. They go, you need to be racing your bike, and they kind of bring you in and they start showing you things, and they show you some things, and then you just kind of sit tight. And you go for some rides that that you put in as memorable, I hope I never have to do that again, kind of rides. I mean, I've ridden in some horrible weather and just terrible conditions. But, you know, you're watching what they're doing. You're learning from them. You're trying to perceive, okay, so he does this, he does that. And my favorite guy, when I first started racing, I had two mentors. One was Scott Carter, and the other one was Russell Marin. They're both Connecticut riders.
Yeah, I know Russell, the Marin name.
Yeah, Russell won the States a number of years in a row.
Yeah.
Very, very strong guy. He was my roommate. And so he was going to UConn, and he was going to nursing school here.
Oh, really?
And we shared an apartment, and he met me at a bike race down in Norwich, which was tied in with the Rose Arts Festival.
Yeah,
you remember that?
Yeah.
And, you know, he...
So he was your mentor type
He
guy.
Was my mentor. Well, he won the race, and I was second.
Whoa.
And, you know, he won the race and was all by himself, and I was second and all by myself. And he was standing there at the line watching me come across the line. He said, who are you?
Yep.
We need to talk. And so that's how I got to know Russell. And riding with Russell taught me how to ride down hills without thinking. And because that guy was just phenomenal, fast, fast, fast. Mm-hmm. And I would ride with him, and I was 132 pounds and, you know, 5'9". I mean, I was just a little skinny guy.
Yeah, that's the way
and
that's
I could, I could climb.
Yeah,
and
sure you could.
I don't have an engine, but I have a great, you know, strength to weight ratio thing going on.
Yeah.
So I never had the big wattage that some of these guys have now. I mean, you take a look now, and it's phenomenal, some of the wattage these guys are putting out. But I had the ability to carry my bike up over a hill faster than most people could. So Russell and I would just, I've ridden thousands of miles with him. We would go out and we would ride and I would work him as hard as I could up the hills and then hang on for dear life everywhere else. And that's how I learned how to race my bike. And then off you go. But, you learn by kind of doing and watching and hopefully you pick up a few skills along the way. But as we know, it doesn't matter how fast you are.
No.
It's a game. There's a game
that
involved.
That was the hardest part for me.
Mm.
I raced a few years longer than I thought I would, just so I could put into practice myself some of the things I'd learned by being a coach. Sitting on the sidelines with Eddie B and then being in follow cars, I said, I got to try that. That's stuff I never knew.
Yeah.
I got to try some of this. So I raced a little bit longer and started getting placing in some bunch sprints, which I never was able to do.
Right.
And started having some, at age 34 or something, I was still placing, 18th in the national championship. And
That's great.
I was coaching and then jumping back on the bike. But
yeah,
I my mentor, one of them, several of them, but John Alice, come on.
Yeah, no kidding.
I describe it as I made the mistake of beating John. That's how I described it. John said to me, well, why don't you come live with me for a week? And then we'll go back to Quebec, Montreal, and then we'll go out to the Nationals. Mm-hmm. Well, I paid for that week. I paid for that victory.
Oh, I'll bet you did.
Training with
he
John.
Tortured you, didn't he?
Oh, my God. We were up in tomorrow's easy day. We do 40 in the morning. We don't do 40 in the evening. So we did 40 before 7 a.m. on the rest day.
On a rest day?
Yeah.
Mm.
And we did it in 2 hours.
It was probably not a slow 40, I'm sure.
Oh, my God. And the gears he used. I'm there, John, you're riding a 4217. He said, that's all I ever train with.
Right.
Just shut up and ride with me.
Right. Spin. Yeah.
So that was one example. Yeah.
Well, it's like Joe Sailing.
Yes.
He does a lot of clinics and does a lot of coaching. He's very involved down in New Jersey, obviously,
yes.
And I've known Joe for a very long time. And he was actually a Fuji rep when I was a Fuji rep.
Oh, was he?
So we both worked for them at the same time.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. And I got to know Joe, and he's just a great guy. But he did a clinic up here in Connecticut a number of years ago, and Fran went to the clinic. It was a women's clinic, wasn't it?
Oh, really?
And she went to the clinic, and Joe talked about a couple of different things, but one of the things that set in Fran's brain when he said it is the cyclist that spins the fastest is the fastest. and how true, because if you got the same gear and you're sitting alongside of someone and they can turn it over a little higher RPM than you can, they win.
That's leg speed is it. And of course, coaching the juniors with Eddie B, that's what you saw.
Right.
You're just watching these juniors just spinning that gear out. You're going, LeMond was riding Pro 1-2 races, junior gearing.
Russell made me take my big ring off the first year.
Did he?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a 48-tooth big ring.
Wow.
That was it.
And
I spun my legs out like crazy.
And
I still have a higher cadence than most people do
when
I'm out riding. People are always commenting on, boy, you really move your legs around fast. Well, that's what I was taught to do.
Yeah.
And then, when the next year, now I'm being dragged off to the Stowe Road Race and Putney and Lake Sunapee and all these classic road races, big hills, and you needed a big gear for those.
Yeah.
Because I remember coming down the backside of Smuggler's Notch, and the police car was there with a radar gun on us.
Oh, really?
And, we got away. It was a 10-man break, and we got away on it. And, it was really weird because I'm so used to being able to climb away from everybody, and then you go up there, and there's a whole bunch of guys like me. And so, the game changes. And we get up and over the top, and we're going down the other side, and we're working it out, getting together. We got a double pace line going. We're flying down the hill, and they clocked us at, 56 miles an hour going down the backside of Stowe.
That's extremely
which was
fast.
Really fast, and I'm thinking, I can't do this forever.
Anytime you get over 50, that's really fast.
Really, really fast. And that eventually, of course, it got closer to the finish line, and my legs said, okay, we've had enough. game's over, but still finished well, but not, didn't win that one.
Yeah, those were great.
But what?
Did we go over it twice?
Yes. You cross the dirt road and then the little bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the Tour of the Valleys, of course, Putney, Vermont.
I did that once.
Classic race, yeah. Really classic. Three climbs on it, the last one being the one-mile climb up into the apple orchard.
That's right.
At the finish line.
Yeah, I only rode it once, so yeah.
Oh, that was a great race.
Yes, it was. Doug Dale and Alice had phenomenal races up that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. Good stuff. It's just, there's just so many great memories from bike racing. I love racing my bike. And you know, the bike racers, they take care of one another. It's a community of, yeah, we're out there to beat one another in the race, but they also are really tight.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So that's been my feeling anyway.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. We're gonna have to do this again sometime.
Okay.
If you would be nice enough to come back, because we never even got to talk about the Jersey Project. You have this wonderful book with all the jerseys. We could do that another time. That
sure.
would be great too. So you know, it's been just a pleasure to have you here. My guest today has been Bill Humphreys. He is a legend in the bicycle world here in the U.S. Obviously, you have a lot more to talk about, and we're going to be looking forward to that book, too. So whenever you get that going, I really want to talk to you about that. We can bring you back on the air for that, too.
Oh, absolutely.
And do something with you.
Okay.
It'll be a nice little thing. You have any way of people getting a hold of you? Do you care that people get a hold of you?
Oh,
you
no. They can look it? At, they can find me on Facebook. They can find my The Real Bike Guy fan page, The Real Bike Guy blog, therealbikeguy.com.
Okay.
And I'm available for speaking. I'm speaking down in Delaware at a bike club down there, and I'm speaking at the Rafa Club in New York City and maybe at the Mystic Velo Club. So telling stories, showing video. And people want to contact me for that, I'd be glad to hear from them.
Yeah, I'll tag into your Facebook page. I'd like to kind of hear you. It'll be fun. This would be a fun thing to do.
Well, thanks for having me up. This has been great.
We'll do it again. We'll definitely do it again. So I'm going to move on here next week. Not one, not two, but three Mad Dog certified spinning instructors live on the air, which is going to be a fun time. We're going to talk a little bit about spinning and indoor cycling. My name is Pedlin Ron. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk with my co-host, Fran Storch, a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you want to contact us, you can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. If you're listening to this on podcast, you can reach me the same way. This is Pedlin Ron. Remember, keep that rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS, Storrs, Connecticut.